on side one. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Vapor Intrusion Pathway, a Practical Guideline. Today's training was developed by the ITRC Vapor Intrusion Team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Roxboro, North Carolina. I'm going to serve as a moderator. I'm going to cover some introductory material in the next few slides, and then quickly turn the presentation over to our instructors. As we go through the presentation, you are in control of what slide you're on. The slide number is in the upper left-hand corner, and the instructors are going to say that as they go through the slides. If you're using the clearance system, the series of orange buttons along the top allow you to navigate. The double left button brings you back to slide one. The single left button takes you back one slide. Most often you'll be using that third button, the single right arrow, to move forward one slide at a time through the presentation. The double right fast forwards you to the last slide of the presentation. The house button takes you back to the presentation overview page. That's where we started today. The question mark button is there primarily for our simulcast audience. Our simulcast audience is hearing today's training through their computer speakers. If you're in the simulcast audience and you have a question, select that question mark button, type in your question. I'll receive that as a moderator, and we'll get through as many questions as we can during the question and answer break. Anyone is welcome to use that question mark button at any time throughout today's presentation to send in a comment or a question. For our phone line participants, you are welcome to ask your own questions out loud, but we do ask that you wait until the designated question and answer breaks. We have one in the middle and another at the end of today's presentation. As listed on the slide, today's training course is based on the ITRC Technical and Regulatory Guidance Document, Vapor Intrusion Pathway, a Practical Guideline, and the companion document, Vapor Intrusion Pathway, Investigative Approaches for Typical Scenarios. Today's training is an introduction to these documents, and we encourage you to download the documents themselves, and we'll take you to a link at the end of the presentation where you can download the documents if you haven't already. Today's training is brought to you in cooperation with the EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. They have a CLUIN website that we're using today. Today's training is going to provide an overview of the vapor intrusion pathway and information on the framework, investigative tools, and mitigation approaches. If you move to slide two using that orange right arrow button, I'm going to talk very briefly about ITRC. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States and is a network that is led by state regulators. ITRC now includes all 50 states and D.C. Federal partners are Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency. ITRC members also come from industry, and those ITRC members participate through the ITRC Industry Affiliates Program. We also include members from academia and community stakeholders. ITRC addresses a wide variety of topics and produces documents and training, like today's training. I listed the ITRC website at the top of this slide. You can go and learn more about what other topics are available and see if you're interested in becoming more involved with ITRC. On slide three, this is our disclaimer and copyright. We include this information in all ITRC training presentations. We ask you please read over the slide. In short, it says we've tried to provide accurate and reliable information, but do not warranty this material. We recommend you check with local, state, federal laws, as well as experts. ITRC does not endorse any specific products. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted, so please ask permission before using. On slide four, this is a list of training topics that we're offering in 2008. You can see that we offer a wide variety of topics and are continuing to develop new courses this year. You can go to the ITRC website and select Internet-based training to read more about each of the training courses, access archives of many of the different training courses that are listed here, and see the schedule for 2008. On slide five, some logistical reminders for everyone to review on the left, especially if you joined after I got started. On the right, today's presentation is going to start with an overview and then discuss the framework. We're going to have a break about halfway through for questions, and we do ask that you hold all of your questions until that question and answer break. In the second half, we'll talk about investigative tools, mitigation, and then summarize. At the end, we'll take you to some links to additional resources, as well as the link to the feedback form. And we do ask everyone on the call today to fill out the feedback form. We do use that information and would appreciate if you just take a couple of minutes at the end of the training class to provide us with feedback. At the end, we'll have more time for questions. On slide six, I'll introduce our instructors. All of our instructors are members of the ITRC Vapor Intrusion Team. Bill Morris is an environmental scientist with the Kansas Department of Health and Environment's Bureau of Environmental Remediation, located in Topeka. He's the Bureau's Quality Assurance Officer and has been the Kansas point of contact for vapor intrusion since 2001. Bill's the co-leader of the ITRC vapor intrusion team. The other co-leader is John Boyer of the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. Tom Higgins is a hydrologist with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and serves as the agency's contact for a vapor intrusion-related issue. He works on a variety of projects, including petroleum site investigation and cleanup, as well as petroleum brownfield sites. Jay Hodney is a product specialist with W.L. Gore & Associates, located in Oakland, Maryland. He oversees the technical, business, and administrative aspects associated with the Gore surveys. He's been employed with Gore since 1992. David Folks is the president of EnviroGroup Limited, headquartered in Denver, Colorado. His experience includes vapor intrusion screening, investigations, Johnson's and Edinger modeling, indoor air testing, background source evaluation, building mitigation, and expert testimony. If you move to slide 7, I'll turn today's presentation over to Bill Morris of the Kansas Department of Health and Environment. Bill?
Thanks, Julia. I hope everyone can hear me. I'd like to welcome everyone to our training, and this is about the documents that the vapor intrusion team did produce. Primarily, the training will be over the guideline, but we'll cover both documents. This slide here pretty much speaks for itself. We've seen the headlines. If you haven't, they're probably coming to an area near you. It's definitely crosses all the barriers, and it's making its way through the environmental community. And no sites are left untouched by this. New York recently started opening closed sites where they'd already had records of decision in place, and this just keeps getting further and further down the road. ASTM has recognized that this is a problem, and they've developed guidance during property surveys to try to identify possible vapor intrusion conditions during real estate transactions. So it's real, it's here to stay, and we're trying to fill in some of those gaps with this type of training in the documents. With that, we'll move to slide number 8, and I'm briefly going to talk about basically the makeup of the vapor intrusion team. It's important to understand how the documents are developed. This team was formed in 2004. We worked through 2006 and released our documents in early 2007. The team is made up of primarily state members, which is important. All the teams are led by state regulators. But the combination of regulators, industry, stakeholders, federal partners makes the document well-balanced and certainly unbiased. It is important to remember that the documents are guidance. They are not regulation. They are not restrictive in any way. And it does cover a lot of aspects and tries to give enough information from an unbiased point of view. And that really does make up the strength of the team. Some of the other things that the vapor intrusion team worked on is a comprehensive survey back in 2004. And with that, that was the baseline that we based all our decisions and how to write the documents and what information was needed. And copies of that survey are at our website, and obviously the website's at the bottom of the slide. And I'll talk a little bit about that survey in a minute, as well as we'll get in more detail of the two documents. If we move on to slide 9, this is a brief overview of the second document, or the companion document to the guideline. I'm going to briefly touch on this just so that you can see that it's out there. And it covers more of the technical approach. It's not the background information. It actually goes through the decision processes from the guidance document and works you through some common sites. One thing I will point out, that we are developing classroom training to go along with this. And the classroom training will go through the guide, and it will bring in a scenario that actually works through those decision processes and helps you make decisions based on data that you do get. Moving on to slide 10. This is some of the results. The next two slides are basically the results from our 2004 survey. And at the time, it was very important to understand where the vapor intrusion team came from and what the concept of formulation of the team and why it got funded and why the documents were developed. And at the time, you can see by this graph, that the majority of the states that responded, and we did have an overwhelming response from all the states about this issue, and that just gives you a little more idea that even in 2004 of how much of a hotbed of an issue this really was. And as you can see here, most of the states didn't have any formal guidance, and they were relying on EPA's 2002 guidance. To date, I think the number is upwards of 20 to 21 states now have guidance in some form or fashion. And a lot of states are moving away from EPA's guidance. Moving on to slide 11. I like this slide here because it points out that no programs in the environmental field are left unscathed by vapor intrusion. And it's very important to understand that it really doesn't matter what program you're operating under or what constituents you're operating within. Vapor intrusion is real and it does happen. And as you can see, all the respondents pretty much hit every program with almost the same weight. And as we go through this, it would be nice to ask the same question again and find out if this is actually true or not. But unfortunately, we won't get to that point. Let's get into what we're going to learn today. Moving on to slide number 12. This is basically the format of today's presentation. We've broken it down into four portions of training. You'll get two, and then we'll give you some time to do Q&A, and then we'll do the last two. All of our instructors were on the team. All of our instructors are vital members of the team, and hopefully you'll enjoy hearing from them as we go through today's training. The training today is based on the two documents, the guidance document, which is Vapor Intrusion Pathway, a practical guideline, as Julia said, and the second one is Vapor Intrusion Pathway, investigative approaches for typical scenarios. And both of those are on our website, as the website was given to you earlier and we will give to you later too. All right, getting into the training, let's move on to slide number 13. These bullets here are the basic things that we're going to cover in this first module, just the overview. I'm trying to give you just a background of vapor intrusion and some of the basics that you'll need to understand. And keep in mind that all of this information that's covered today and during this section is in the document in much greater detail and depth. So I encourage that you have those two documents and you at least read through them, because there's a wealth of information in there. And in the time frame that we have on this training, we can only cover bits and pieces. So I will go over each of these bullet points in a little more detail on the next slides before we kick it off into the next session. Moving on to slide 14. First thing we need to talk about, what is vapor intrusion? This is the definition. We stole a definition from the EPA document, or we used it with their permission, I guess is the real thing to say. And based on this graphic, it pretty much depicts that all buildings, regardless of type, can be affected by vapor intrusion. Back in the day, we used to think that you had to have a basement for vapor intrusion to occur. And what we're finding out, that's not necessarily the case. Crawl spaces, basements, slab on grades, combinations, old houses, new houses, they all can be impacted by vapor intrusion. And whether you have an old house or a new house may or may not be beneficial. So it's a very building-specific thing, and we're finding that that's one of the things that makes this pathway so difficult to investigate, evaluate, and determine whether or not you really have a problem or you don't. I can speak from experience here in the state of Kansas that when we first started looking, of course, we went through some kind of screening criteria and tried to pick the worst sites we possibly could, or the ones that were the best candidates for vapor intrusion. And we went like 10 for 10 in the first 10. Since then, we started to find more sites that are not impacted, but at first it was kind of scary when the first 10 sites you look at all have vapor intrusion at some level. You start thinking, wow, were we going to get all this money, time, effort, people to deal with this? But of course, we picked those sites because they were most likely candidates. So as we've moved through the process and moved down that initial screening ranking, we're finding more and more sites that don't necessarily fall into the vapor intrusion trap, so that's good news. It's not that all sites are going to be there, but it is important to understand some of the concepts that you'll learn about today. Moving on to slide 15, I'm going to slightly touch on the basic conceptual model. And this is a pictorial representation of what simplistically may be going on in the environment to cause vapor intrusion. You saw the definition. Now this is the pictorial depiction of that. As you work through the process, and keep in mind any vapor intrusion investigation should be phased or iterative, where you gather data and you refine this conceptual model so you understand some of the things that are going on at the site. And believe me, in most cases, it's not this simple. You'll find that the conceptual model grows and becomes really, really difficult to interpret based on geology and water conditions and building conditions and all these other factors that go in. And the conceptual model does help you think through those processes, and it really does guide your decision making as you go through that process. Moving on to slide 16. This is a list of some of the working principles that the document is based on. As I talked about, it is phased and it is iterative. The document covers the generic screening, what you do first. We even cover how you develop generic screening levels. And we'll get into a little more detail in some of the later discussions from the instructors. I'll cover some more of this in greater detail. We talked a little bit about the conceptual site model and how you use some of the tools, and that'll be one of the areas in this talk that we go into detail, some of those investigative tools that you'll use to gather data that you use during your conceptual site model. And we talk about multiple lines of evidence. In the document, we primarily talk about multiple lines of evidence as it pertains to indoor air. As we've grown through this process, we're starting to look at more lines of evidence and trying to find other ways to look at those lines of evidence and not necessarily always have to collect indoor air. But there's a lot of debate over the whole multiple lines of evidence and which lines of evidence are the best to collect. And as we go through this process, it's important to understand that we're on the front side of this learning curve, and we do have a way to go before we completely understand all the dynamics with vapor intrusion. The other things that are covered, again, in greater detail are the site use. It does make a difference in some states, whether they're residential, non-residential, commercial. Levels change. Some may not change. Whether OSHA is involved. Those are all things that you have to deal with for your specific regulatory agency. And then we talk about consultants. It is important to really have a consultant that has experience or has some training in this area, because it is a difficult pathway. And then one of the other big strengths of the document is how we deal with the community. Vapor intrusion is a little different than most, because it's at a heightened awareness in most communities, because once you start sampling for vapor intrusion, in a lot of cases you are directly interacting with the public. And it's important to keep that in mind, because it does change the dynamics of a lot of the environmental field work that we're doing out there. Moving on to slide 17. This slide covers some of the special influences that we deal with. Indoor air sampling seems to be the most practical thing to do to measure where people are actually being exposed, but background is a big issue. And there's a lot of information, a lot of studies out there about background, and from experience, it is a difficult thing to do, collect samples in someone's home and then try to relay the information, not only from the chemicals, the concern from a particular site, but all the chemicals you may find in the indoor environment that have nothing to do with vapor intrusion. And it is one of those things that makes this facet of the environmental world a little different than most. Biodegradation, one of the things that you need to be tuned into is that petroleum hydrocarbons do biodegrade, and there are markers and there are ways to determine that. And there's a big difference in vapor intrusion plumes that are petroleum hydrocarbon and chlorinated hydrocarbon. So, you know, you deal with those two things, and states have different policies set in as far as distance criteria. As an example, here in Kansas for chlorinated solvents, we look at 100 foot from the boundary of contamination, whether that's a groundwater plume or a soil source. With petroleum hydrocarbons, we've lessened that distance to 40 feet. So, I mean, that gives you an idea that the biodegradation does take place with those petroleum hydrocarbons. Preferential pathways are a little difficult. Preferential pathways, we consider them to be things that move contamination into directions or areas where you don't expect them. Every house has plumbing and utility corridors that go in and out of them, so we don't really consider those preferential pathways. That may be preferential flow into the building, but if the contamination is under the building, we don't consider those preferential pathways. Preferential pathway would move it in a direction that we don't expect. If you have a large utility corridor that takes it perpendicular to the plume, or you have fractured bedrock that takes it in an opposite direction, or an upgradient or side gradient direction from the plume, those would be considered preferential pathways because they influence the migration of the volatiles in an area where you wouldn't expect. And those are things that really change the whole dynamics as how you screen a site. And then land use. Land use is big, as well as undeveloped land. What do you do? How do you assess vapor intrusion if there's no buildings on there? This is still up for debate, and I think you'll find different answers when you go from state to state to state and you start dealing with those issues. And last, the policies. One of the things that's really difficult about vapor intrusion is the numbers that you're looking for. They will vary by orders of magnitude from state to state to state based on the chemicals, toxicity, things of that nature. So that throws in another wrench as far as how you deal with vapor intrusion when you cross state boundaries. Moving on to slide 18. As I spoke earlier, community issues. This is really sensitive to most community members. You'll find that the first time you go out and knock on someone's door and you're talking about vapor intrusion, it's really hard to get your hands around what's actually going on out there, and then you're going to tell people there's contamination getting in their homes. Inform them early, inform them often, keep them involved. There's a lot of good information in the guidance document that talks about community support, and we have an appendix in the back, Appendix A, that was written by two public community stakeholders, and it does give you some information that sheds light on what community members and their anxieties and things of that nature. With that, I think we're up to slide number 19, and we're going to move this on to the next instructor, and I would like to turn it over to Tom Higgins from Minnesota.
All right. Thank you, Bill, for the introduction. And the second component of today's training is going to focus on the framework of the ITRC vapor intrusion guidance document. And as Bill mentioned in the overview, the conceptual framework that is presented in the document is a generic investigation framework that you can use to investigate the vapor intrusion pathway. It should be noted that as different states may have different specific requirements that might be applicable, it's certainly something that you'll want to check with the specific states you're working on, as certain aspects to a vapor intrusion investigation framework may vary from state to state. But in general, what we're going to be talking about here in this component of the training is really focusing on text and material from chapters 2 and chapters 3 of the guidance document. And the framework has really been broken down into two phases. The first phase being the preliminary screening phase, which is steps 1 through 7 of the investigative framework. And in the preliminary screening phase, you're essentially using existing site data that you have already collected. And if that existing data is indicative of a worst-case condition for the site you're looking at, the preliminary screening phase provides a framework to assess that information and make a determination regarding the vapor intrusion pathway. Now, if the existing information that you have is not sufficient to make that final decision, you would then go into the second phase of the framework, which is the site investigation phase, or steps 8 through 13, which we'll talk more about in more detail here. So moving on to slide 20, here we have the seven steps identified from the preliminary screening phase. And again, this is material that's covered within Chapter 2 of the guidance document. And as I mentioned on the previous slide, if the preliminary information you have available is indicative of worst-case conditions for your site or representative of worst-case conditions, these seven steps are really designed to help you structure and frame up that existing data to make a recommendation regarding the VI pathway. Beginning with step one, here we're really looking at and assessing existing information to determine, do you have an acute exposure concern or an immediate public health threat that would require rapid action to be completed. Step two is really looking at, as a whole, the existing site characterization data you have, and is that characterization data sufficient to provide an evaluation for the vapor intrusion pathway. Step three is asking a question whether the contaminants of concern at the site are volatile and toxic, and we'll talk a little bit more about what that definition means later on. Step four is asking a question regarding where are potential receptors and buildings of concern in proximity to the identified volatiles at your site. Step five is a decision point where screening criteria are going to be applied to the existing data you might have. And this is a point in particular that we'll talk more about later, but this is one area where you'll want to check with your individual state regulatory agency, as the screening criteria may be set depending on what state you're working in, and they may be different values depending on which state you're working in as well. Step six is a comparison step where the existing data is compared to appropriate screening criteria, which then brings you to step seven, which is asking the important question, does an exceedance exist that would warrant further investigation? So moving on to slide 21, here we have figure 2.2 of the guidance document, and this is really a flow diagram that kind of outlines some of the questions from the previous slide in steps 1 through 7. Now, on this particular slide, I would like to point out that we've emphasized and enlarged the text for steps 3, 4, and 6 on this slide, which in this particular case, if the information you have from your preliminary assessment is indicative of worst-case conditions, these are potential exit points in the investigation and or in the preliminary screening phase, rather, that would lead to no further action. So beginning with step 3, the question asked in step 3 is taking a closer look at the site contaminants of concern and asking, are the contaminants considered volatile and toxic? Now, the guidance document goes into some depth on what that definition truly can mean. However, in general, the definition of volatile and toxic could include the volatile organic compounds, or VOCs, but it can also include chemicals such as hydrogen sulfide, mercury in some cases, or methane, perhaps. It's not exclusive to just the volatile organic compounds, so that's something to keep in mind. In essence, if volatiles are not present, then the vapor intrusion pathway would not be complete and therefore not of concern, so no further action or no further work would be appropriate. The second exit point is in step 4, and here you're taking a little bit closer look in regards to the proximity of buildings and receptors of concern to the volatile impacts for your site. As I mentioned before, this is a particular area where you'll definitely want to check with the state regulatory agency you're working with, as states may have different definitions of what is meant by proximity from buildings to the chemicals of concern. In general, if you do not have potential receptors or buildings of concern in close proximity, depending on what that definition is, to the chemicals of concern for your site, then the vapor intrusion pathway would not be complete and not of concern. The final exit point in the preliminary screening phase is in step 6, and this is a comparison step where the preliminary site data you have from the preliminary screening phase are compared to the screening criteria that have been chosen and applied for your site. Now, in general, if the concentrations you have from the preliminary screening phase would be below the appropriate screening criteria, then the vapor intrusion pathway would not require additional information to be collected. It's worth noting, and Bill mentioned this in the overview, that the guidance document does go into quite a bit of depth on screening criteria, how they're developed, and provide some information on how screening criteria can be developed if you do not have any available. Appendix H of the document covers quite a bit of information on screening criteria, and it's worth noting that, in general, screening criteria are generally developed using fairly conservative assumptions that may err on the side of mitigating when mitigation may not necessarily be needed, perhaps. So moving on to slide 22, here again we have figure 2.2 from the guidance document showing steps 1 through 7. However, here we've emphasized steps 2 and step 7, as these are two particular decision points within the preliminary preliminary screening phase that can potentially lead the investigator to collecting additional information. And it's worth noting, before I go into step 2 and step 7, that there's the little balloon off to the left of this figure that indicates mitigation can take place at any time. And this is really a theme that holds true at any point during the vapor intrusion investigation that's outlined within the ITRC document. Mitigation is certainly a step that can take place at any time. However, that decision might be influenced perhaps by the regulatory agency you're working with. So there again, you would want to be working closely and have good communication with the regulators you're working with. But getting back to the decision points, step 2 would be our first decision point where additional investigation might be required that would lead you to the site investigation phase. Here we're really looking at and evaluating the existing site characterization data for your project. And if that existing characterization data is not sufficient, you would essentially have to be filling in those pieces of information that are missing or data gaps within the site conceptual model. And the site investigation phase can be used to try and develop what pieces of information might be necessary for that assessment to take place. The second decision point is in step 7. And here we're looking at evaluating if an exceedance of existing data occurs, does that exceedance warrant further investigation? And if the answer to that is yes, you would then proceed to the site investigation phase, or steps 8 through 13. And it's worth noting, as we mentioned earlier, we will touch in a little bit more detail later in today's training on how some of these questions can be applied and answered within our companion scenario document by outlining very briefly in a couple of slides how one of those particular scenarios could be applied to some of the steps we've just talked about here. So moving on to slide 23, here we're looking at the site investigation phase of the ITRC vapor intrusion guidance document, and this is focusing on a lot of the text and material from Chapter 3 of the document. And just as we covered in Chapter 2, much of the information on the next series of slides is going to really just touch briefly upon each of these steps listed, steps 8 through 13. And it's worth noting that at this point in the investigation, the determination has already been made that data gaps are essentially present within the site conceptual model that are preventing a decision from clearly being made regarding if mitigation is required or if no further action is appropriate for the vapor intrusion pathway. Steps 8 through 13 really outline how those data gaps can be clarified, with steps 8 including the decision and choosing of an investigation strategy, designing a vapor intrusion investigation work plan in step 9, followed by the implementation of that investigation work plan in step 10, the evaluation of such data in step 11, with leading to the decision point in step 12, asking if additional investigation is necessary, and finally if mitigation is warranted. So moving on to slide 24, here again we have a flow diagram outlining steps 8 through 13, and this is from figure 3.1 of the guidance document. And as I mentioned on the last slide, steps 8 through 10 really help the investigator describe and identify specific data gaps and information that's necessary to determine and produce an evaluation regarding the vapor intrusion pathway. This decision for additional information should really be driven and based upon data gaps that have been identified within the site conceptual model. And here again, good communication and working with the state regulatory agency is going to be important, because there may be specific requirements that are part of regulation for your particular state that may dictate which types of data and information will be allowable for the vapor intrusion investigation. Data collected within the site investigation phase can truly originate from multiple different locations and several different types of sampled media. For example, groundwater, soil gas, or even interior observation information from particular buildings of concern. So one of the steps that really has to take place when you get to the site investigation phase, and this is where the iterative nature of a vapor intrusion investigation takes place, is you'll notice in some of the expanded boxes here that you have to go back and reassess some of the earlier steps from the preliminary screening phase, such as, does new information that you've collected identify if you have an acute exposure scenario present? So this iterative process of any time that new information is added to your conceptual site model, you have to go back and continuously update that model, is one of the several complexities that has to be taken into consideration with the vapor intrusion pathway. And again, it's worth noting that at any time within the process, the choice to mitigate can be made, depending on how the regulatory agency you're working with would decide to move forward with that decision. So moving on to slide 25, here we take a little bit closer look at step 8, which is choosing an investigation strategy. And as I mentioned before, the decision on what types of data and information can be used in a vapor intrusion investigation may be somewhat set by the specific state and regulations that would apply to this particular pathway, depending on where you're working at. But in general, the additional data needs should really be based upon data gaps within the site conceptual model that's been outlined for the particular project that you're working on. Now, the investigation strategy as a whole can include the collection and information of data from interior and exterior locations within respect to particular buildings of concern. Now, the guidance document in Chapter 3 goes into more detail on the pros and cons for different types of data sources that can go into a vapor intrusion investigation, and we'll go into a little bit more detail on those later. One of the things that should always be kept in mind when additional information is required are what are the analytes of concern that you're looking for. Analyte lists and detection limits for those analytes are something that should always be kept on the forefront when new information is determined that it's needed for the particular site. Detection limits for specific analytes should always be at or less than the identified screening criteria, and we'll talk a little bit more about data quality objectives within the next portion of today's training. It's also worth mentioning that supplemental data sources can be very valuable for the vapor intrusion pathway, because there are many complexities associated with constructing the conceptual site model for the VI pathway. Supplemental data sources such as flux chambers or qualitative observations just through an assessment, an interior building assessment of a particular receptor and building of concern, can be extremely valuable. And we'll talk more about supplemental data sources later on in today's training. Moving on to step 9, here we've listed out a few bullets regarding the design of a vapor intrusion work plan. And I'm not going to go through each of these bullets individually. However, I've mentioned before, and it's worth noting again, that within the site investigation phase of the vapor intrusion assessment, identified data gaps that exist from previous assessment that's taken place should really be driving the need for additional information, which is based upon a site-specific conceptual site model. And information is presented in the guidance document regarding each of the items listed on this slide. So moving on to slide 27, here we take a little bit closer look at step 10, which is the implementation of a vapor intrusion investigation work plan. And vapor intrusion investigations are always going to be somewhat site-specific. Scheduling is certainly one issue that can definitely crop up from project to project. And as we mentioned in the overview, this particular pathway is such that it can be a little bit more, it can be a little bit more of a headache in the sense that flexibility and property access with particular property owners is definitely going to be something that you'll have to work with individual property owners. And it's also something that can cause an issue perhaps, that will have to be closely watched, moving forward with the investigation. Seasonal issues can also be something that can crop up from time to time. The guidance document goes into a little bit of information regarding the collection of subsurface soil gas after heavy precipitation events occur. You may find that some state guidances may not recommend that these type of samples be collected after a certain time period after significant precipitation events have occurred. So this is something that's definitely going to be a case-by-case decision, and the guidance document just provides a little bit of information on some of those situations. Slide 28 looks at step 11, which is the evaluation of existing data and new data that would be collected for the vapor intrusion investigation. And this is a pretty important step where really the investigator is integrating the qualitative data sources that have been collected along with quantitative data sources throughout the course of an investigation. Keeping in mind that the overall goal is to really be able to make a sound, defensible determination whether or not the vapor intrusion pathway is complete and if mitigation is warranted and required. It's an important step to really bring together all of the individual lines of evidence that have been collected, along with revisiting the preliminary screening steps that were identified in steps 1 through 7. This is really necessary because of the iterative nature that's necessary to update and provide a clear conceptual site model for the VI pathway. Slide 29 is taking a little bit closer look at table 3.1 from the guidance document. Table 3.1 provides a brief summary on how specific types of information and data collected from different and various media can be evaluated from the vapor intrusion pathway, along with providing some pros and cons on the interpretation of these different data sources. I'm not going to go through each of the boxes on this table individually. However, as an example, if at a particular stage of an investigation you would have a combination of different types of information, such as indoor air, subslab, or subslab data along with groundwater information, the document provides some information on how you can use the multiple lines of evidence approach to evaluate that information and determine if vapor intrusion is occurring. Slide 30 takes a little bit closer look at the lines of evidence approach for decision making in the vapor intrusion pathway. And here on the left side of the slide, we've listed or presented figure 2.1 of the guidance document, which here again is a little bit more detailed version of a conceptual site model for vapor intrusion, which outlines many of the different factors and variables that are taking place within a vapor intrusion investigation. On the right, we've listed some bullets, both quantitative and qualitative in nature, quantitative data sources such as soil gas and groundwater information, along with qualitative information such as building construction and condition information for particular structures of concern. Now, the multiple lines of evidence approach provides a strength for the vapor intrusion investigation within the ITRC document, as this can really be used as a good way to take different pieces of information, weave them together into a conceptual site model to provide good sound recommendations if the vapor intrusion pathway is complete and mitigation is required. This type of an approach really forces the investigator to kind of take a step back and look at the big picture of all the different variables and items that can be taking place and interacting with each other regarding the pathway as a whole. Slide 31 is an example of one particular evaluation technique discussed within the guidance document and particular line of evidence approach, which is looking at constituent ratios. Constituent ratios can be a pretty valuable source of evidence, either showing that vapor intrusion is occurring or providing evidence that vapor intrusion may not be occurring and may be related to other sources or particularly of concern background contaminants within the indoor air environment. Constituent ratios are really just taking the ratio of concentrations of chemicals from two different sampling intervals and then comparing those ratios as a line of evidence. In this particular example we have on the left side of the slide, here we're looking at the concentrations of TCE and DCE in the subslab environment through subslab soil gas sampling, along with an indoor air sample result showing TCE, DCE, and PCE in the indoor air environment. And this is a particularly useful technique and way to use a constituent ratio evaluation in particular, because with indoor air sampling data, the measured concentrations you might be looking at may be attributable to background contaminations associated with the ambient air of a building or chemical compounds that may be present within the indoor air environment, or it may be the presence of, or it may be the result of subsurface intrusion into the indoor air. Evaluating similar compounds of concern between these two different sample intervals can help provide and show evidence either for or against vapor intrusion. As an example, if the chemicals of concern in the indoor air would be due to vapor intrusion, you'd expect that the ratios would be similar, and you could get an expected attenuation range for these chemicals between the subslab and the indoor air environment. In this particular example, it's worth noting that TCE is present within the indoor air, however, is absent from the subslab sample, indicating that TCE in this case may be attributable to a background contaminant source rather than a subsurface source. Moving on to slide 32, here we're looking at step 12, which is a decision point within the investigation stage of the vapor intrusion pathway investigation, asking if additional information is necessary. As I mentioned, this is a decision point really designed to, and determined to assess if the site has been adequately characterized and if risk from the VI pathway can be assessed and a decision made regarding mitigation or if additional investigation is needed. If a risk cannot be determined or if risk cannot be determined from data collected to this point, then additional investigation may be required, which would then, at that point, you would go back to step 8. Where you would assess what types of data are necessary to fill in the data gaps that would exist preventing a decision regarding either monitoring, mitigation, or no further action. Slide 33 is looking at step 13. And step 13 is really asking the question, is mitigation warranted and necessary? After evaluating the existing data you have, determining if no additional data is necessary, the decision to mitigate may be clear and should be based upon all the data collected to date, both qualitative in nature and quantitative. Now, the particular regulations you'd be working with in the state may provide the ability to allow long-term monitoring versus mitigation if the concentrations detected would be right on the border of whatever screening criteria you would be using. Mitigation alternatives and options are going to be presented later on in today's training. And at this point, I'd like to turn things back over to Juliana, if she's still on the line here.
I'm still here. Thank you, Tom. We're now on slide 34, and we're going to take a break for questions. For our simulcast audience, it's that orange question mark button that's going to allow you to send in your questions. For our phone line audience, you are welcome to ask your own questions. Please state your name, location, and you're welcome to refer to a slide number. Remember, for our phone line, remember to unmute your line, and that's *7 to unmute using our system. Do you have a question from our phone line to start? From the simulcast, I have a question. I unfortunately missed a comment that Bill mentioned in relation to slide 17 regarding the difference between chlorinated hydrocarbon and fuel hydrocarbon plumes. Could Bill confirm the distance he referred to?
Yeah, Julian, I can. I was talking specifically with Kansas and how we use different distances for chlorinated plumes or chlorinated solvents and hydrocarbon. And each state will be different or may be different, so I encourage you, as you get into that, check with the regulatory agency before you use any of the numbers quoted here. Specifically in Kansas, we use 100 feet for chlorinated solvents, and we use 40 feet for petroleum hydrocarbons.
A simulcast question from Ursula McKnight at University of Tübingen in Germany. What is the recommended sampling interval time for comparing constituent ratios?
I'll take that one. This is Bill again. Wow. Most of the time, samples are collected, and I'll give you the range of samples that are being collected. If you're comparing to groundwater are usually grab samples or low-flow samples, something in that nature, where you get your concentration data. Soil gas samples are primarily taken as grab or short-duration samples. When you get to subslab, primarily they're short-duration grab samples. I've seen some longer-distance sampling. It doesn't seem to have too much of an effect. And then when you look at indoor air sampling, commonly I think most people are using 24-hour time-integrated samples, but radon industry suggests you can take longer samples. There is some data out there that suggests you can take grab samples. You have to take more of them, but if you're using on-site analysis, that may be a way to go to get an average for the day. So there's no clear-cut decision, and it really depends on the media, but a lot of them are really short-duration samples within 24 hours.
Thank you. Do we have questions from our phone line audience? From the simulcast, we have a comment from Darren Brown at CDM in Wichita. He says, you can have a soil vapor plume that can migrate independent of the groundwater plume. Do our instructors want to comment?
Well, I'll comment on that. I absolutely agree with that. But one thing I will point out that most of the vapor plumes will, of course, the primary mechanism in the subsurface is diffusion. So I don't expect plumes in most geologic settings to migrate away from the groundwater plume in a direction more than that 100 feet. If a preferential pathway is in place, and I'll give you an example, we have a site here in Kansas, it's located in a fractured bedrock media. We have a groundwater plume that goes several thousand feet to the southwest, yet we had about 30 homes we had to put mitigation systems on that were northwest of the site where there was no groundwater, although it was very perched groundwater, had no contamination at all, and it was primarily through the fractured bedrock coming in contact with the foundations. So it does happen, and we do find that sometimes the vapor plume will outlead the groundwater plume, but it's not going to be hundreds and hundreds of feet. Generally, it's probably within 100 to 150 feet from the edge of the contamination.
A simulcast question from Mike Elbrick at Hart Crawler in Seattle. For industrial commercial sites, are OSHA PELs typically considered when setting screening or cleanup levels?
Wow, that's a tough issue there. One of the things that I would point out with the OSHA levels versus non-residential or commercial, I would work with the states that you're involved in to determine that. We had a survey in 2006 that's on our website where we talked about states developing screening levels, and one of the other questions that we were looking at is how do states deal with that. A lot of states don't have firm guidance or policy on that, and Kansas is one of them. We have numbers published for residential. We deal with the non-residential on a site-by-site basis. One state mentioned that they were using the OSHA PELs as their commercial regardless of whether or not they were using the chemicals. But I think what you'll find is a lot of states will use OSHA values when the chemical of concern is being used in the facility already, whether it's vapor intrusion or not, and there's already a worker-to-employer relationship based on the chemical that's in place. On issues where you have a commercial setting where they're using no chemicals and vapor intrusion is occurring, I'm guessing that in most cases you'll be looking at a risk-derived non-residential number, similar to a residential number.
Thank you. And a simulcast question from Heather Ridgway at ATC Associates in Atlanta, Georgia. Can you please repeat how we can obtain the full set of training documents? And this is Juliana, and I'll answer that one. At the end, we're going to take you to some links to additional resources. And if you'd like, you're welcome to fast forward to that last slide. That's going to go to the links page. And in section one, there's a link that will allow you to download today's presentation and also download the documents that serve as a basis for today's training presentations. You can go over to the ITRC website, and then you can download the PDFs of those documents. Do we have questions from our phone line audience? Then we'll go ahead and wrap up this question and answer break. I'd like to thank everyone for participating so far. Please double-check to be sure that your phone is on mute. We want to be sure that we eliminate background noise and don't have any joining us in the second half of the training. So we are picking up a little bit of typing, so if you happen to have taken your phone off mute, please be sure that it is back on mute. To use our system, it is star 6 to mute your line, and I'll remind you at the next question and answer break, star 7 to unmute. On slide 35, we'll now start the second half of today's presentation. And I'll turn our training class over to Jay Hodney at W.L. Gore & Associates. Jay?
Hello, and good morning or good afternoon, everybody. What I'm going to do now is take this further into the guidance document. And I just want to kind of remind or refresh everybody that up to this point, Bill and Tom have taken us through the first couple of chapters in the guidance document. And Tom took us through the steps 1 through 13, that the ITRC vapor intrusion team put together, and he laid out the steps and the rationale behind the steps. And for this part of the training now, we're going to focus a little bit on the site investigation steps 8 through 13, but we're going to do that by looking at one of the scenarios, and that's going to be the second part of this section of the training. But what I want to do now is introduce the toolkit, or the toolbox, as we call it, Appendix D, and just kind of summarize the various sampling techniques and the media sampled in a vapor intrusion investigation. If you haven't had a chance to look at Appendix D, it's worth a cup of coffee and a walk through the pages. It's a very comprehensive discussion on the various approaches to sampling soil and groundwater, soil gas, and so on. All right, so let's move on to slide 36. And also in the toolkit, we added in a section on data quality objectives. And Tom touched on this in various slides during his part of the presentation. But, you know, we wanted to remind everybody when you're doing a vapor intrusion investigation that you need to begin the investigation with the end in mind. And that's to determine if the intrusion issue is real and is it a risk. And so you need to set out or lay out your data quality objectives. Define and identify the study goals and the contaminants of concern. Perhaps complete some sort of a pre-sampling building survey, maybe an interior survey to see what kinds of source material and activities are going on within a structure. It could even be an exterior screening level soil gas survey to gather information on the presence of various compounds in the beta zone and their distribution across the site. Also establishing your sampling and analytical method plan and the number of samples you want to collect and what are the appropriate reporting limits, and then go out and collect the samples. And certainly you need to have a quality assurance plan in place and a procedure to validate your data as well as your sampling procedures. So just a reminder that shows up in the toolkit as we're working our way through vapor intrusion investigations. Let's go to slide 37. And now I'm going to kind of take us through each of the various media that can be or may be sampled during a vapor intrusion investigation. And here we have groundwater sampling. at many sites, maybe not all sites, but probably a lot of sites, there may be some existing groundwater data already through a network of monitoring wells. And concentrations of those contaminants of concern can be a good indicator of the potential presence of those compounds in the fatal zone beneath houses or offices or whatever kind of building you might be investigating. So it's a good idea to review the well location construction to see if you have a well screened across the water table. Review the aquifer characteristics. It'll shed light on the migration of the contaminants and the water level trends. You may have, if you have enough wells, you may be able to interpolate the groundwater contaminant concentrations to a regular grid and look at the estimated concentration that might be beneath a building, for example. And if you're asked to collect new data, new groundwater data for new wells, it's recommended in the toolkit that you design and locate them to address the vapor intrusion concern. Perched water, there's other kinds of groundwater situations that can get kind of interesting. Perched water may show up. I can speak from experience. Oh, it's been many months now, but we had been doing some soil gas sampling, and the results were not making sense to a regional contaminated groundwater aquifer at depth. And it turned out there was some clean perched water sitting above that. So various things you need to watch out for. And often, you know, incorporating a long-term monitoring program is appropriate as the contaminant plume migrates. It may impact structures that were clear of the area of intrusion initially. And in the toolkit, Table D1 summarizes some nice or some typical common groundwater sampling techniques. Slide 38, then. This is on soil sampling. Generally, in the vapor intrusion community, soil data alone is usually not acceptable for making decisions in a vapor intrusion investigation. It is an existing line of evidence, and certainly if it's available, it's good to look at. You can screen in a site, but generally it's not used alone to screen out a site. There are some calculations available in the literature that allows you to convert to a soil gas concentration or an estimated concentration to give you a potential idea of the concentration of vapor in the vato zone. If you're asked to sample or collect some soil data, we recommend in the guidance document to do sampling techniques that obviously minimize the volatile loss of the organic compounds. So slide 39 then. Now we're getting into the vapor sampling arena here, soil gas and indoor air. Generally, vapor data in the various forms are preferred for vapor intrusion investigations. They provide, or that type of data provides, a direct measurement of the contaminants of concern that could infiltrate or be present in a building and pose a risk to human beings. Generally, the risk-based levels for vapor intrusion are up to 10,000 times lower than, say, levels that you might collect with a soil gas sampling program for more of a typical site assessment program. So you need to combine a robust sampling technique and a sensitive analytical method to allow you to achieve these lower detection limits and the increased sensitivity required. Now, in the toolkit, we talk about two approaches to soil gas sampling, active and passive. Active approaches where you draw a soil gas sample through a driven or drilled rod into the ground and you mechanically extract that soil gas sample. A passive technique is where you bury an adsorbent that's housed in some kind of a container, and then the compounds in the vato zone soil gas are diffusing to the adsorbent. And there are a number of considerations in the appendix of the guidance document. These are things that you need to be aware of or watch out for when you're collecting a soil gas sample. And there's a number of them there that pertain to active sampling techniques. The last one pertains to passive sampling techniques in the slide. Anyway, the toolkit or the discussion is quite comprehensive in the guidance when it comes to soil gas sampling. Slide 40 then is looking at subslab soil gas sampling. This may represent the soil gas and the contaminants of concern that are most likely to enter the structure. and you might want to collect indoor air samples concurrently for comparison to the sub-slab soil gas data. You can sample at the slab base or at any depth beneath the slab, depending on what the objectives are. You can go through the slab in two different ways. You can either install permanent sampling points or temporary points, both of which need to be sealed off effectively to prevent future infiltration of vapor or groundwater or what might be lurking beneath the slabs. Permanent points are nice because then you can revisit those points and you can collect multiple subslab soil gas samples over time. And in my experience, I've had more people, homeowners or commercial operators, are a little more receptive to the idea of a permanent point than one that is considered temporary. I'm also with permanent points if you're in somebody's home or in a building of, say, a dry cleaner where they've got an operation going on, and it's a good idea to make sure that these installations are flush mounted so it doesn't disrupt the daily activities. And again, both techniques are available, active or passive approaches. There's two examples that are shown in the slide. And there has been some research going on in reference to the last bullet on the slide of coming in from outside a building and reaching at an angle beneath the slab or right near the slab to collect a soil gas sample, and is that representative or conservative compared to a true sub-slab soil gas data point. Okay, slide 41 then, we're looking at indoor air sampling. It's going to be kind of up to your regulators on when you perform the survey, or the sampling, I should say. Generally, it might be performed after subsurface sampling has been completed, or you can do it concurrently. Some exceptions may be in case of emergencies due to spills, or you've got concentrations reaching explosive limits. Obviously, you want to take care of that as quickly as possible. In the toolkit, we discuss doing a pre-sampling building survey. You want to document the occupants' behaviors. Are they smoking? Are they storing paints and solvents or lawnmowers in their basement? What are those potential sources or chemicals that are present? Appendix G has a nice, useful indoor air questionnaire to conduct the pre-sampling survey. Generally, we focus on the contaminants of concern that are found in the elevated levels during the exterior soil gas or in the subslab soil gas investigation. As Bill touched on a little bit there, length of sampling to get a time-integrated sample seems to be how folks are doing this. Again, methods to do it, you have both active and passive methods, whether they're a canister-type collection or deploying some absorbents into the atmosphere that are collecting compounds over time. And locations, crawl space samples are important. You want to collect enough, mixing up topics here. You want to collect enough samples to characterize the indoor air adequately. It might be one sample per floor, maybe enough for residents. If you're looking at large apartment complex, you know, collecting one sample on the third floor in a middle hallway probably would not characterize the overall air adequately. And other samples that you can collect for air sampling might include crawl space samples, if you have a crawl space beneath the floor in the ground. Ambient or outdoor samples can be collected for comparison to the indoor air concentration and so on. And slide 42, as Tom talked about it earlier today, there is a lot of great information that you can collect from supplemental tools and supplemental data. It might be quantitative or qualitative data. And in the appendix, in Appendix D, we list and discuss briefly a variety of these topics, whether it's tracers or what I like, forensics, where you're doing some chemical fingerprinting, isotopes and so on, or multivariate statistical techniques that can kind of tease out relationships in the data that might not be evident from less sophisticated statistics. Meteorological data, wind speed and direction of wind and air pressure and so on can help you understand the data that you're collecting in these vapor samples. And there's a variety of tables D3, 4, and 5 that discuss additional toolbox information summary form. And then Appendix E also has a nice discussion on quality assurance, quality control considerations for the various types of soil gas and air sampling techniques. So let's shift gears. And again, just to repeat, Appendix D, the toolkit or the toolbox, is a nice collection of information around techniques and media sampled for vapor intrusion investigation. So now what I want to do is shift gears and take us through a scenario. And I'm going to look at, here are the scenarios that you'll see in the scenarios document. A gas station, a residential neighborhood, dry cleaner, brownfields, and so on. These are put together by the ITRC VI team. We believe they represent some typical investigations that you may have experienced or you might experience in the future. In the following slides, we're going to focus in on scenario 3. That's the large industrial facility with a long contaminant plume under many buildings. And each of the scenarios discuss probable real-world investigation, and they look at the selection and the practical application of the tools from Appendix D as well, and the reasons or the rationale for those choices. So it's kind of a neat compilation of scenarios and how the investigators are addressing the issue to get through to the end, what that objective is at the end. So again, on slide 44, as both Tom and Bill indicated, it is an iterative approach. It's a stepwise approach. The scenarios discuss the site description, the situation, the conceptual site model, and then it goes through basically the steps 8 through 13 now. And I need to stress that the dialogue in each scenario is not meant to be marching orders or how to conduct a vapor intrusion investigation, or that this is what the ITRC team has recommended one do to conduct a VI investigation. Rather, each one is based on a probable real-world situation, and it describes the issues and how they were tackled and the questions that were answered. The dialogue might fit your investigation, but more often than not, very site-specific questions, and you'll probably deviate somewhat from these scenarios. One thing that I do like about the scenarios is that each one discusses what is unique. What are the key issues about that investigation, and what were the lessons learned? And together these two elements define what is unique about the scenario. And I always found that to be some pretty good information. So let's go on to slide 45. And again, what you'll see in this particular scenario and the other scenarios is a site description. And here we have groundwater 15 to 30 feet below ground surface, a very long plume of chlorinated compounds. You'll see some information about the lithology at the site. There'll be some information in the scenario about the types of structures and the number of structures, perhaps, that are potentially impacted by vapor intrusion. In this case, there was a groundwater hotspot at concentrations 100 times the groundwater screening levels. And if you've been listening to presentations over the past couple of years in the vapor intrusion conferences, you'll hear the discussion of Redfield site brought up. So this scenario is similar to that site. Let's go to slide 46. And again, the process discussed in each scenario follows a progressive and iterative process. The decisions and the rationale behind the decisions at each step are discussed. And in this slide and in the next slide, you know, the decision and the rationale for choosing a specific sampling procedure or tool are discussed as well. And we also included the sampling alternatives with their respective pros and cons. So in this particular scenario, we utilized the hotspot approach begin the investigation, and then we stepped out in an iterative manner, you know, two buildings at a time out from the source area based on the results. And those decision points are determined in the work plan. And again, this is similar to the Redfields investigation. So on slide 47 then, here's where we listed the sampling alternatives, various approaches one could take as an investigator. And it's a reasonable spectrum of sampling options you'll see in the first column. And then in the next two columns, the various pros and cons. And this kind of a table is laid out in each of the scenarios. So, for example, one alternative here in Scenario 3 would be to investigate the entire area where groundwater concentrations exceeded the groundwater screening levels. And the pro here is it'd be a very comprehensive investigation. The con, of course, immediately it'd be fairly expensive. Now, in this particular scenario, we chose the last row there, the focus area on the hottest part of the plume, and then step out as needed from there. And it's less cost, it's less disturbance initially, but there is some risk that you may not, that some of the impacted receptors may be missed in this type of, an approach. But again, each scenario has this kind of a layout in terms of the sampling alternatives and the strengths and weaknesses of each. So on slide 48, again, the part I like is the key issues and lessons learned. So what was unique about scenario 3? Well, public communications and outreach are essential. You have lots of buildings and different functions in these buildings over a large area. And so communicating clearly to the public is essential and very important. Finding the worst-case building selection could be a challenge with so many choices. And when you have wider variations, you've got a large, long groundwater plume, you can expect quite a bit of variability in the geology, the aquifer characteristics, the building conditions, even background sources. So all of these different elements of variability can make the investigation rather complicated. Then when you have a scenario like this or a situation like this, managing the resources are difficult. Logistics can be overwhelming, and certainly expect surprises. Each site, each situation will be unique. And then slide 49, we move into the next steps. And each scenario finishes with a section that discusses step 13, is mitigation warranted. So in the scenario, you'll see the work plan that details the next steps. In this case, there was a source control remedy that was considered for implementation. To reduce the overall concentrations in the groundwater and therefore in the soil gas. Ongoing groundwater and soil gas monitoring was recommended in the scenario. As contaminated groundwater migrates farther away from the source, it could be impacting buildings in the future that were not on the list for investigation now. And it was recommended to collect vapor data over time and begin to build a soil gas concentration database and determine the attenuation factors, and you might be able to then use that information as kind of an initial screening tool to identify other areas in the region that might become or are a vapor intrusion trouble spot. And any kind of mitigation that's put into place, the system that's put in place is going to require some inspection, testing, maintenance, and so on. And always keep the community involved. That's clearly important. So, with that concludes my part of the training. And we went in to a greater detail in the site investigation phase of the guidance document, mainly through the scenario. And then also I took us through, briefly, there's so much information in the Appendix D, the toolbox, it's hard to cover it all here, but I tried to summarize that information for you. And so if now you find yourself at the end of your VI investigation, and the conclusion is that intrusion exists and is a risk, and we need to move to mitigation, that's what the next section of the guidance document will discuss. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to David Folks, sitting somewhere in sunny Colorado. David?
Thanks very much, Jay. And it's not so sunny here, but pretend it is. And welcome, everyone, to the mitigation and the final chapter of the ITRC guidance and this training session. As you all know, we're getting into allergy season here, so if you hear a few seconds of silence, I'm probably just taking a drink of water and I haven't run away. Jay did a great job of summarizing the various tools and strategies we have available to us for evaluating the vapor intrusion pathway and trying to figure out whether or not it's a complete pathway. And as Jay indicated, often the end result is that mitigation is required. But I want to stress, as Tom did earlier on, that the decision to mitigate is often made at various stages of the process. Some of you, in fact, many of you may be aware of or familiar with the new ASTM standard practice for vapor intrusion evaluations during real estate transactions that just came out in March of this year. And that standard introduces the term preemptive mitigation, which essentially means mitigating before you really know whether you need to or not. And that's designed to accommodate the needs of people in property transactions that just may not have the time or the money to go through an evaluation process, so they just mitigate anyways. So let's get started. Slide 50 introduces the mitigation chapter, and it starts off with a discussion of the general approaches to mitigation, because there is more than one. The guidance then gets into more details on one of those approaches, which is building control options. And then, because we have options, the guidance talks about the various factors that might affect which one you'd pick. And then, unlike many mitigation guidance documents that I've seen, the ITRC guidance gets into some of the life cycle issues associated with mitigation, from design and installation through performance monitoring and closure. So it's a pretty comprehensive chapter and a pretty good resource for those of you that get to this stage. Let's flip to slide 51. And when we talk about vapor intrusion mitigation, most of us immediately think of building control. But that's really only one of the three options that we have. The guidance talks a bit about site remediation and institutional control approaches to mitigation. On slide 52, we'll talk a little bit about the first approach, which is site remediation. And we don't want to forget about this. The concept, of course, is that by cleaning up contaminated soil or groundwater or NAPL that's causing vapor intrusion, we're eliminating the source of vapor intrusion. So in some cases, that may be sufficient to deal with the vapor intrusion problem. We might dig it up. A permeable reactive barrier might stop dissolved constituents from flowing in groundwater underneath a building, and so on and so forth. The vapor intrusion guidance doesn't get into the details of how to do site remediation. That's covered by other guidance documents and other training, but it does remind us that we should think about that before we start going down other paths. Now, while site remediation does remove the source of vapor intrusion, frequently it takes too long to accomplish. We've got an ongoing pathway, perhaps people being exposed right now, and we can't wait the months or typically years it might take for site cleanup. So while we still may do site remediation for other reasons, or even as a long-term goal for vapor intrusion, we often combine site remedies with other approaches, such as slide 53, which is institutional controls. And most of you are probably familiar with institutional controls through groundwater or soil cleanup. They've been a concept's been around a long time, simply using administrative or legal mechanisms to prevent the exposure from occurring, such as preventing buildings in a certain area, or maybe preventing a certain type of use like residential. We see institutional controls very commonly at brownfield sites with vapor intrusion concerns. An example would be the Midvale Superfund site, where new residential buildings over the plume area require radon systems or subslab depressurization systems, whereas commercial structures don't. The BP, former BP refinery in Casper has institutional controls that require new buildings to have vapor intrusion mitigation systems installed if the soil vapor concentrations are high enough in the building footprint. And they also prevent residential structures in that area. So pretty common to see institutional controls used at least as part of a remedy for vapor intrusion. One of the problems with institutional controls, though, is that they're hard to enforce. So typically, we don't just see vapor intrusion institutional controls by themselves. Let's flip to slide 54 and get into the meat of things, and that's building controls, which many sites often employ. The guidance goes into quite a bit of detail on each of the technologies shown here, basically involving some kind of barrier or venting or pressurization or depressurization approach. I'm not going to try and describe them all, but I'll talk more about the first two that are highlighted in magenta there, passive barriers and subslab depressurization, in part because they're really the most commonly used approaches today. Let's turn to slide 55, and this is just simply to give you an idea of some of the tools, the type of information you'll see in the guidance. This table shows, in summary form, typical applications, challenges, and costs for four of the technologies that are covered in the guidance. And again, I'm going to be talking more about passive barriers and subslab depressurization as we go forward here. With that, let's go to slide 56 and talk about passive barriers. The concept here, I'm sure most of you realize, is that we're simply creating a physical barrier trying to stop the upward movement of vapors from the ground into the building. And what we're really relying on is for that physical barrier to either allow the vapors to build up in concentration below the structure sufficiently that they diffuse laterally by chemical gradient, or we're hoping that some kind of natural ventilation will remove the vapors for us. In either case, the integrity of the barrier is critical for the operation of the successful functioning of this type of remedy. Passive barriers are pretty popular with developers these days. They like them because they don't involve an operational component, and there's at least they perceive that there's less stigma associated with a passive system as opposed to something with fans and motors and that kind of thing. However, there are several issues associated with using passive barriers, and the guidance discusses those in detail. I'll just highlight a few here, and I've already mentioned that the barrier material needs to have integrity, needs to be thick enough to survive the construction process, work boots and rebar and concrete aggregate and all that kind of stuff. You need a very good quality control program to make sure your liner survives construction and is properly sealed. And the ITRC guidance strongly recommends that any passive system still have the ability to be upgraded or converted to an active system if needed, if the results of testing, which you should do, show that the active or the passive barrier really isn't achieving the indoor air reductions that you need. And of course, finally, and maybe most important, in most cases, you shouldn't expect a passive barrier system to have equal performance to an active system, particularly if they both have a barrier and you have an active system to remove the vapors. Let's turn to slide 57 and talk about active systems. The most popular and the most commonly used by far is subslab depressurization, and that's also known as a radon system because that's what they were first developed for in the 80s and 90s. They work in a manner shown by the cartoon on slide 57. They're pretty low-tech, really. A hole is cored through the basement or sub-slab concrete, and we dig out a little hole below the slab, stick a pipe in, seal it, and then use a fan to create a suction that pulls the vapors into that suction pit, and then exhaust those vapors above the building. For residential buildings, in any case, they're pretty inexpensive. $1,500 is a pretty common cost. Sometimes they can be a little more, up to $3,000. If they're much more than that, it's probably a situation where subslab depressurization wasn't the best technology to pick there. As indicated in the advantages column, they work pretty darn well. We see up to 3 orders magnitude reduction in concentrations, and probably can achieve more. And really only wet or low permeability soils are the Achilles heel of this technology. The guidance goes into a lot more information, shown on slide 58, for example. Talks about the number of suction points you might need. We find one or two is typically adequate for most homes. And they can easily be modified to meet homeowner preferences, for example, where the pipes are run or where the suction points are installed. We can combine a sub-slab depressurization system with a sub-membrane system, which is what you would install in a crawl space. Or we can depressurize cinder block walls or all sorts of things to accomplish the goal. So it's a very flexible approach to vapor intrusion mitigation. Slide 59 just introduces some of the topics under technology control or control technology selection. Each of these is a subsection in the guidance, and obviously whether you have a new or existing building might affect what you pick. It's difficult to put a passive barrier under an existing building, but it's very commonly employed with new buildings. You might do something different in a commercial building, such as HVAC pressurization, than you would in a residential building. And foundation condition or type might either help or hinder generation of suction below your slab. For example, if you've got grade beams, that might make it hard to propagate a suction field for depressurization. Or if you've got very tight soils or high water table, that could also make depressurization a challenge. The guidance does talk about ways you can get around high water tables. Of course, simply by lowering the water table through French drains, but you can also use that drain system as part of your depressurization network by sealing the sump and putting a vacuum on your sump and pipes. And or you could build a false floor in some cases and depressurize below that. So there's different ways to deal with high water tables or go to a pressurization approach that doesn't involve depressurization. Chemical of concern is something that you or should be concerned about. We worked with Bill in one case in Kansas where there was actually a free apple below a building and an explosive situation. And in that case, you want to use intrinsically safe equipment that's not going to cause a spark or ignite during operation. Turn to slide 60 and talk about another part of the guidance, and that's design and installation issues. There's really two approaches to design for, certainly for complex buildings or single buildings. The most common and traditional approach is to do some, inspect the building, do some pre-mitigation diagnostics like pressure testing, and to go away and design a system, get it approved by the agency, and then come back and install it. And And, of course, that works very well. That was one of those sips of water there. But in some cases, you may have a neighborhood with a number of houses that are similar in construction, similar conditions, and radon installation contractors are pretty familiar with what it takes to depressurize those homes, particularly if they've already done several for your project. So in those cases, it may be possible and even preferable for the contractor to go in, install a system in consultation with the homeowner, and then use the system itself for conducting the diagnostic tests. Another thing to keep in mind is, I think Jay was talking about, it's often not the mitigation itself that's a challenge, but the dealing with homeowner preferences, scheduling, just getting access to the building. And, of course, lead-based paint and asbestos issue shouldn't be ignored either. Let's go to slide 61. And I apologize for my voice, but I think I'll make it to the end here. Operation, maintenance, and monitoring, another important component of mitigation, and that's covered in the guidance as well. For subslab depressurization systems, operation is usually pretty straightforward, particularly for home systems. Just electrical costs, maybe $100 a year for a typical home. Emission controls may or may not be required depending on the jurisdiction. But otherwise, really, occasional fan replacement is the main maintenance item that we see with these types of systems. Maybe resealing of membranes to foundation walls and crawl spaces and things like that. Monitoring requirements really vary agency to agency. In some cases, a single post-mitigation indoor air test is sufficient. In other states, they require continued testing over time until the quarterly, semi-annual, and maybe annual testing until the system is no longer needed. In some states, indoor air testing is required, and in others, pressure gradient test showing that you have downward pressure if it's a radon system is all that's required. And typically, you'll see inspections required on about an annual basis for the systems. And let's turn to slide 62. And that last but not least is closure. When we install these systems, sometimes it seems like they'll be operating forever, but we hope that there will be a day that we can turn them off, or that at least they'll no longer be needed for VOC control. The homeowners may, or the building owners may, still want to use them for radon control or moisture control or other purposes. But in any case, we really need to think about how we're going to come to the decision to stop mitigation when we install these, not when we come to the end of the program and realize that we really don't have the decision-making structure in place to figure that out. In addition, you'll find that you may want to collect information during the operation of the system to make closure decisions. So it's a good idea to think about that right at the beginning. So that completes the mitigation section of the guidance. The mitigation chapter covers the various technologies that are available in a lot more detail than I just did, design and installation, O&M, and closure procedures, and is really a very comprehensive resource for those of you that get to this stage. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Bill for a summary.
Thanks, David. I hope everyone can hear me. Well, you've come a long way today. You were given a lot of information. I'd like to keep in mind a lot of what you've seen is cursory information. We don't have near the time to go into great detail in any of the subject matter that you've got today. And those two documents are by far, a tremendous resource that I encourage everyone to download and at least peruse. And in summary, basically, we gave you an overview of how the team was made up and the strength of the team, and what was the premise of the documents that were written and where that expertise comes from. We talked a lot about the practical guideline, and most of the slides that you saw today in instruction is based on the practical guideline and how to use that document. As far as it is very process-oriented, you really have to do some critical thinking when you're collecting data. And as several instructors pointed out, you know, the steps are a framework. You don't follow all the steps all the time. A lot of times you combine the steps, so it is important to really think about that, and it is very iterative. As you collect data, you're making decisions and you're interpreting data, so you're going back and forth. And then Jay took us through the tools, and as he pointed out, there is a tremendous amount of information in Appendix D, and that coincides with what's in Chapter 3. A lot of the appendices that are available in the document are wonderful things that you can tear out of the back and hold on to, as far as how to deal with soil gas data. Home inspection checklists is an example. The toolbox itself and all those charts and tables that we have about the various investigative tools. And then Jay touched a little bit upon the scenario and, you know, our decision making as we went through the process. The one thing that we had to do is, even as the expertise on the team is probably higher than most, we had to really control a lot of the variables in them scenarios so that we can make them understandable from start to finish. And there's a lot of nuances and there's a lot of things that will come about as you do your investigations. One, don't get discouraged, because there's a lot of data that doesn't make sense. But it's important to understand those processes that are going on. And then finally, with David in the mitigation section, it is by far the best document of anywhere that has all of the mitigation strategies lined out in great detail with cost information, so on and so forth. So I would like to thank all the instructors and Juliana, because this has been a great opportunity for us to put this training on. With that, I will turn it back over to Julia. Juliana.
Thank you. On slide 64, did you go over that yet?
I have not.
Well, that's a new slide.
That is a new slide. I was wondering if that was going to be in here. I will briefly touch on this. As of now, we do have a group of individuals that are working on a classroom training. We plan on having a much more detailed discussion on what you've seen, what you've heard today. Along with that, we will have a lot of hands-on type demonstrations of the equipment, things from the toolbox that you will see in these slides and in the guidance document, and how you expect to use them, and things that may or may not go wrong when you're taking those types of samples. And we're going to have problem sets where the class works through those steps, those decision making, and actually work on a site that is, it is hypothetical, but it is in, it is a real world situation that we've all dealt on, and it should be a wonderful 2-day session, and our first public session will be in Portland in October of this year, and we plan on doing 3 to 4 a year for the next 3 years. So I highly recommend people start looking for information on those trainings also. Thanks, Juliana.
Thank you. On 565, we are coming up on our second question and answer break, but I do want to take you to the links to additional resources before we get that. So if you select that area of the slide, that's going to take you over to our links page. And we have made this URL available for you, because this is going to continue to be a resource that you can turn to. The first item I want to point out is how to get to the feedback form. So if you look to the left, the third button down is the feedback link. And that's going to allow you to fill out feedback for today's training class. This is information that we can use, and we really value Your input to help us improve our training courses overall, as well as this course specifically. Looking to the right, you can see the links from today's training. The first item listed, Download Today's ITRC Training, allows you to download the presentation that you've seen during today's training class. In addition to what you've seen on the slides, more information is available in the speaker's notes section of the downloaded version. The next link is the Vapor Intrusion Pathway of Practical Guideline, the VI-1 document, and then following that is the Investigative Approaches, the VI-1A document. Those blue buttons are going to take you over to the ITRC website, where you can download a PDF of both of those documents. Continuing through Section 1, there's other ITRC resources that are listed in Section 1. In Section 2, we have some documents that the team has put together as a resource for you, and they put together this list of documents as a resource for you. And then, of course, we have a link over to the ITRC website and to the CLUIN website. We now do want to take time for questions. If you're in our simulcast audience, you need to go back to the slides and use that orange question mark button to send in your questions. For our phone line audience, you are welcome to ask your own questions out loud. We ask that you state your name and location and refer to a slide number if you'd like. And remind you to unmute your phone. If you've used our system, it is *7 to unmute. Do we have a question to start from the phone line audience?
I have a question. My name is Bert Vogler with Kleinfelder.
Yes.
I work in Long Beach, California, and the California EPA has issued their own guidance levels for comparison with soil vapor data for vapor intrusion concerns, the so-called California Human Health Screening levels. And the guidance says that they're basically designed for comparison with soil vapor samples collected within 5 feet below a building slab. You folks talked some about sub-slab sampling, and I'm wondering about what you folks feel the advantages or disadvantages are of sub-slab sampling right beneath the slab as opposed to, say, at 5 feet below the slab.
David, I'll cover that. This is Bill. I think one of the things that you have to be careful about is when you're talking about exterior soil gas, what they're trying to do is make sure that you're getting a conservative estimate of what the soil gas may or may not be. And I think that's where the recommendation of 5 feet below the slab level or the foundation level be the appropriate place to sample. As you move away from the source, in most cases, the groundwater is the source and the volatilization, you start to get in a little more spatial variability, and that's one of the concerns, and there is some recent data out there that suggests a near slab sample, which basically means exterior to the foundation at the same depth of the foundation, not correlating. And I will exercise a little bit of caution there because there is mainly only one data set to suggest that that's a real big issue. So you want to make sure that your site, your lithology, things of that nature, and you're collecting enough samples. Sub-slab samples are great because it does give you an indication of what's getting in the building. I will caution you with sub-slab samples, though, that the slab itself is a two-way street. You will find indoor air constituents in the sub-slab also, and sometimes that can be confusing, and I've seen it in quite a few commercial buildings where they're a little more positively pressurized, and so the advantage of the sampling where and when really come into the building and some of those other characteristics, but the 5 feet below is, I think, from an exterior soil gas perspective.
Thank you. A simulcast question from Craig Barnitz at Utah DEQ in Salt Lake City. In the toolbox section, Jay mentioned that indoor air sampling is generally done after sub-slab testing. But as a less intrusive sampling method, and if you can attempt to eliminate background interference, why isn't indoor air sampling used to screen for building residences with the highest indoor air concentrations, and then use that data to identify where to do the sub-slab testing?
I can try and answer that. This is Jay. I think it's going to depend a lot on what your state agency is asking you to do. With indoor air sampling, there's always an awful lot of background, or can be a lot of background contribution to the signal. So if you collect an indoor air sample that has a very high concentration of something, does that necessarily mean it's coming from a subsurface source? So I think the way we position it in there is, I mean, you can collect indoor air samples any time or whatever your regulators want, but generally, I believe, and you guys helped me out here, that kind of the outside-in perspective or sampling procedure is preferred, that it's less alarming to the occupants of the house and so on.
Yeah, Jay, this is Tom up in Minnesota. We have, you know, in Minnesota's case, we have a similar approach, starting from the outside in, you know, in an attempt to try and screen sites out before you have to knock on the front door.
Right.
Instead of saying, hey, we need to sample your indoor air. That can lead to a whole series of subsequent questions that can be difficult to answer sometimes. So, I think that's the approach we take. Bill, I'm not sure about for your case, but
well, we use a lot of different approaches. Again, here in Kansas, we have certain chemicals that we don't have to deal primarily with background indoor air sources. In those cases, doing indoor air subslab first before you do any exterior investigations is not always looked at as a bad thing. If I can go into a situation where I can rule out background right from the get-go, I would rather take concentrations or get data from where people are being exposed or may be exposed. So it's really specific not only to the regulatory agency, but it may be the chemical of concern. If it's truly a byproduct of breakdown or biodegradation and it's not in household products, that may forego background issues. Or in other cases where we have a lot of background issues for certain chemicals here in the state where it's very difficult to take indoor air samples. So what we're going to look at doing is taking subsurface, whether they're soil gas or subslab only. We've taken that route too. So it really is very site-specific and very state-specific.
I just want to add another 2 cents. This is Dave. I agree with Bill. And also, if you just collect subslab data, which may be appropriate in many cases, you then have to figure out what your criteria for going indoors, and typically it means you have to use a pretty low attenuation factor. In other words, err on the side of conservatism. If you see stuff in the subslab that's 10 times your indoor air target level, does that mean you have to then come back and test indoors? Those are the kinds of decisions you have to weigh.
Thank you. Do you have another question from our phone audience? From the simulcast, Chris McElliott at Braun Intertech Corporation in Minnesota. When choosing a material to use as a vapor retarder to mitigate potential chlorinated VOC vapor impacts to a building, is the manufacturer's specifications for water vapor permanence a primary consideration? How important is the thickness of the material beyond the issue of surviving installation?
Well, those are common questions. And the answer to the first one regarding the water vapor permeability, that's typically not a specification that we look to for selecting a barrier. Typically, if you select a material that, first of all, can survive installation, then typically it will have a low permeability to all vapors. And if it's relatively thick, of course, then that also enhances its ability to impede vapor diffusion through the membrane. What we find is that whether it's a spray-on or an HDPE or a similar material, that people are tending to go to something in the 40 to 100 mil range for sub-slab membrane applications. If it's a membrane that's just going in a crawl space, then it can often be a lot thinner as long as it can be well sealed to the foundations.
A simulcast question from Richard Pollard at AIG Consultants in Houston, Texas. Some analytical results from passive samplers are given only as nanograms with no associated volume. How are those results compared or converted to concentrations or exposure limits?
Okay, I'll try this. This is Jay with Gore. Yeah, it depends on the passive sampler, but typically the most direct reporting is a mass desorbed from the adsorbent. And for kind of site assessment, that's fine. You can do a nice high-resolution map across the site to give you an idea of the kinds of compounds present in the soil gas and the distribution across the site. But if you want to move towards a concentration reporting, then the work that we've been doing is measuring the uptake rate of the sampler. And then once you know the uptake rate and the exposure period, that gives you then an estimate of the volume of air that the sampler has encountered. And then you have the mass and you can get to a concentration. There's a lot of debate and discussion around that when compared to active soil gas results, and there has been some data sets produced. I've presented a few of those data sets at some vapor intrusion conferences that compare the calculated concentrations from a passive sampler to those that are measured by active techniques.
A simulcast question from Mark Turner, a consultant in Wilmington, Delaware. Please comment on the function of soil macropores and vapor plume migration with respect to both soil groundwater vadose partitioning rates and soil plume migrations. Also, please give a short commentary on vapor intrusions in soluble bedrock landscapes.
Wow.
That's your question, Bill.
Wow, thank you. Of course, you're going to ask a non-geologist to talk about macro pores. Where to begin with that one? Juliana, that may be better off that we leave that one to a follow-up, and we can actually provide information through email directly to that.
Okay.
I'm looking at the macro pores being more of a preferential pathway where it induces flow in a different direction, but I may be totally off base with that because that's not my area of expertise.
All right. Well, I have it noted for a follow-up email at the end of the class. Do you have questions from our phone line audience? Another simulcast question from a separate simulcast question from Matthew Turner at the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection in Trenton. He's talking about a site where they installed a mitigation system in a basement of a vacant building, and the benzene is still present in the basement at first floor samples. Can vapors enter basement walls or other pathways or sources?
I guess that one's mine. Well, of course they can, and mitigation systems don't always perform as well as they should, but the tricky thing with benzene is that there are so many sources of that. I'm assuming that the levels observed are above ambient air concentrations. But if there's not a gradient with higher concentrations in the basement and lower concentrations in the first floor, I would start to suspect a background source. You might also get off-gassing of petroleum from contaminated building materials, so that can complicate things. Looking at ratios, as was mentioned earlier, is often a good way to try and figure out whether what you're seeing inside the building came from below the building. But beyond that, it starts to become a very building-specific issue. If you want to email us more details, we could try and tackle it as an email follow-up afterwards.
Do we have any questions from our phone line audience? In a site with fractured bedrock and maximum TEC contamination at the depths of 100 feet, what sort of sampling would you recommend for baseline monitoring?
Oh, in fractured bedrock with contamination to 100 feet. In fractured bedrock media, most of the time what we look at doing here is we go straight indoors and we do sub-slab indoor air crawl space monitoring. One of the things that we're finding, it's very difficult to map soil gas concentrations in the environments we have where we have fractured bedrock. Most of our fractured bedrock is in the eastern portion of the state. It's very shallow in a lot of places. A lot of the foundations are built right on the bedrock, and usually the material above the bedrock is really heavy, heavy clay. So for us here in Kansas, it's very difficult to go out and try to do soil gas sampling. We've used passive sampling to provide us with some areas where we know concentrations or at least contaminants are located, and try to pinpoint houses that way. But that's a tough one. Fractured bedrock, depending on fractures, depending on flow, depending on where the buildings are in contact with the bedrock, those investigative strategies are very difficult. And one of the things most people say, you just can't screen those sites out without physically looking at the buildings. If any of you other guys want to jump in on that.
Yeah, this is Tom up in Minnesota. I would agree with you, Bill. We have a good portion in the southeast part of Minnesota here where we have some fractured bedrock situations, and in those particular instances, I think every single project is going to be site-specific in the sense that you have to get out and see the structure, look at how is it interacting with the bedrock. There could be situations where you have contaminated source for vapors, whether it be dissolved phase or whatnot, that may be in direct contact with the building itself, in which case, we've gone in and done indoor air or sub-slab if it's attainable, rather than soil gas, because it just may not be attainable to get soil gas. So they're going to be very, very site-specific, I think, in how those are handled.
Yeah, this is Jay from Gore. I have one potential example of a passive soil gas survey I worked on at a site that had fractured bedrock with TC at groundwater depths, I think greater than 100 feet. And one way, we were actually able to detect and report and map the TC and the soil gas there, but it was a fairly high-resolution sample grid. Lots of passive samplers were put out in a nice regular fashion. And when you began to look at the map, you could kind of see the linear features and the contours that were reflective of the fractures that were holding the TC in the groundwater. So, but I agree with everything that's been said. It's a very tricky problem.
Continuing from the previous question, it includes there are no buildings currently on site. And in addition, what type of human health modeling would you recommend?
Wow. This is Bill. Boy, this is really a policy question that you're asking here. And I'll step out on the limb first. As far as future buildings, we don't screen sites here in Kansas for future scenarios. If you're going to screen it, basically if everything comes up non-detect, or you're outside of our existing building criteria distance-wise of contaminants, that's one way to get out of the loop. But from my experiences, the buildings themselves play such an integral role in when and where vapor intrusion occurs. I'm sorry, you're not out of the loop here in Kansas until the buildings are in and we've done sampling. That's just the stance we're taking here to be conservative. Now, other parts of the country, other states do that differently. They'll let you screen out sites based on soil gas or other criteria. So I'm not sure that there's any one answer to that question.
But I think most states will agree that a fractured bedrock environment is kind of an exclusionary condition.
Right.
And I think it would be an excellent example of a need for an institutional control.
Yeah, I won't disagree with that, David. In lieu of testing, just saying that it is going to be a problem, putting preemptive mitigation or institutional controls in place would be one way around it.
simulcast question from Chris McGilley at Braun Intertech Corporation in Minnesota. When passive sub-silab vapor mitigation system piping is being installed, which can later be upgraded to an active system if necessary, is the use of a thinner vapor retarder appropriate, such as a 15 to 20 mil?
Well, it's an excellent question, and I think the important thing to realize is that particularly with an active system, we don't even need any barrier at all other than the slab itself. So the main purpose that a barrier is performing when you have a good venting layer and a slab is it's increasing the efficiency of the venting system. It's reducing the number of suction points that you might need if you do go active. It's reducing the amount of short circuiting that might occur. So really the main criterion for a barrier in those conditions is simply whether or not it can survive construction, because if it can't, then it's not serving any purpose. And really that's the limiting factor on how thick it can or can't be. But just remember that you don't even need a barrier or something other than the slab if you do have a good venting system, an active venting system in place.
And let me add one more thing to that. This is Bill. Dave, you didn't quite touch on this, but you alluded to it earlier. It doesn't take much to render a barrier ineffective. And if you're really wanting to do passive only, I would suggest you upgrade and do the passive barrier correctly. And I'm going to draw from experiences I've had with a few of the crawl space installations that we've had. Typical radon contractors do a very good job of installing these systems, but one of the things that we've come across is when you're dealing with high concentrations, where you're looking at 2 and 3, and I've had a 4-order of magnitude reduction of a crawl space concentration, putting a barrier in works, making it active works, but relatively small pinholes or seams that weren't sealed properly or gaps in the foundation contact almost render them ineffective. And you can find very high concentrations still inside the building at the first floor level, even with an active system running with a barrier in it. So, you know, if you're really truly relying on passive, I don't think there's a substitute for making it, if it's going to be passive only or passive vented. I think if that's what you're trying to do as your mitigation option, you have to upgrade to a much better material.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from our phone line audience? A question from Robert Perry at AIG in Boston. What level of concern should be given to preemptive mitigation, inducing the flow of greater concentrations of contaminant vapors to an access point prior to characterization of spatial conditions?
I'm not sure if I fully understand the question, but I'll take a shot at it. You can ask again if I miss. I think the concern is whether a preemptive system would be pulling vapors and creating a problem where one might not have existed before. And the depressurization involved with these systems is really so small that it doesn't go out any distance at all from the foundation, so that the only thing that you're going to be collecting is vapors that are right there in the immediate vicinity of the foundation. So there's, I don't think, any potential that you're going to exacerbate a situation. If the concern is over how those VOCs are vented, that is an important part of the design. You have to make sure that you don't vent them someplace that's going to go into someone else's building or your own air intake and cause a different problem.
Thank you. We are currently out of simulcast questions, so do we have any final questions from the phone line audience? I'd like to thank our instructors and our participants today. Thank you for joining us. If you have not already, please fill out the feedback form. We do appreciate your taking a few minutes to give us feedback on the training class. For more information about ITRC, you can visit the ITRC website at www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again, and have a great day.